Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of May 24th. This week we spoke with Joseph Califano, who is the chairman of the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University. Mr. Califano has an article in the current issue of America called Criminally Unjust, looking at America's prison policy. Mr. Califano served as the United States Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare under President Jimmy Carter, and was also an aide to President Lyndon Johnson. I began by asking Mr. Califano the relationship between drug and alcohol abuse and imprisonment in this country.
Alcohol and drugs are the chief culprits in crime in America. I'm not talking about violating the drug and alcohol laws. What I'm talking about is violent crime, property crime. What's involved here is a population. 65% of the prison population, about 1.5 million people out of the 2.3 million people in prison, meet the medical criteria for drug and alcohol abuse or addiction. And alcohol is a major culprit here. 57% of the inmates, and we're talking about felony inmates, 57% of the felony inmates in America are in there for crimes in which alcohol was implicated. So the big factor is alcohol. We all think of it as drugs. We think it's heroin or cocaine or a crazy meth addict or what have you. But alcohol is a major factor, particularly when you think about assaults, rapes, murders.
And right now, I'm sure this varies from state to state, but what kind of treatment options are available for people who face these issues in prison?
Very few. This is the real problem. Addiction is a disease. It's a complicated disease, but we now know it's neurological. There's a switch in the brain. It's psychological. It's physical. It's spiritual. It's emotional. We don't provide treatment for that disease. We provide treatment in prison if you've got hypertension, if you need an appendix taken out, if you've got diabetes, but not for this disease. Essentially, only a very small percentage of prisoners get treatment, and most of the treatment is not the kind of treatment you think about when you think about these blue chip places like Betty Ford or Hazleton. Sure. The payoff would be enormous.
Sometimes rehabilitation for prisoners suffering from perhaps drug or alcohol abuse, that's seen as kind of maybe a liberal issue. But as you point out in your piece, that's not necessarily the case. Maybe.
This has nothing to do with it. Actually, this should be the most conservative issue. If you want to reduce crime, if you really want to be tough on crime, the greatest crime reduction program this country could ever have would be to provide treatment for these people in prison. Now think about this. We have 2.3 million people in prison. I mentioned the 65%. But in fact, 82% have alcohol and drug problems of one kind or another, in the sense that they either committed their offense while they were high, they stole money to buy drugs, they violated the drug or alcohol laws, they are alcoholics or alcohol abusers or drug addicts, or they share some combination of those factors. If we provided everybody in prison with treatment, and we only succeeded with 11% of them, and that's low, but it's a difficult population, 11%, it would pay for itself in the first year in which they got out if they remained sober and got a job that a high school graduate could get. After that, the payoff would be about $90,000 a year, maybe a little more. The second point is the reduction in crime would be stunning, because the experts all estimate that on average at least 100 crimes a year are committed by people with drug and alcohol problems. And you just multiply that by 10% of this population that needs treatment, you're talking about millions of crimes. So if you're tough on crime and you're hard-nosed, you ought to be for this.
So we see, in states with budget deficits, these are often the first things to be cut, is any kind of programming for prisoners. Why hasn't this case been made before, do you think?
Well, look, the case is tough. I've talked to state legislatures all around this country. Now, what they say is, my people want roads. They want computers in the schools. They want the wires underground, But in fact, what they should be saying to their people are, you want less crime? we'll give it to you. This will give it to you. This is the best investment we could make to fight crime. You know, people say, we need more police on the street. We need hundreds of billions of dollars for police and cops and equipment and all that stuff. This is the best investment we could make.
You also make the case in your article that treatment can also affect the internal dynamics of prisons.
Absolutely. It's interesting. We know that in the few treatment programs available in prisons, where they have them, the prisoners are calmer, there's less tension, the guards are more at ease, there's less absenteeism among the guards, less problems there. I think there's no question but that, you know, this is a win for everybody. The problem for the politicians is they don't like to make an investment that doesn't pay off for a couple of years because they're up for election next year. Every year is election year, basically, mm-hmm. for the state legislators. Mm-hmm. And incidentally, this is a state problem. The overwhelming proportion of these people, these are felons, the 2.3 million, all but a couple hundred thousand are in state prisons.
So in federal prisons, are the treatment options better?
Not much better. Mm-hmm. And they should be, but they're not. Indeed, one of the things I've often suggested is, to the extent that the federal government provides funds to fight crime under the Safe Streets and Crime Control Act or other legislation, they ought to think about requiring states to provide treatment as a condition of getting that money.
Mm-hmm. Your study also reveals that there's certain differences between male and female prisoners in terms of how they're affected by substance abuse.
Well, there is. I mean, I think the female prisoners are likely to have mental health problems. They're much likely to have been sexually abused or physically abused when they were young or in the course of their life. And let me tell you, I mean, there's nothing, sexual abuse or physical abuse of a child is an express train to substance abuse.
Well, I'm going to pick out a couple sentences from your article that I think really jumped out for us, and I thought that maybe you could talk more about them. You call the mandated prison sentence the most counterproductive criminal justice policy in our nation.
Think about this now. If we have a system in which we say, okay, if you're convicted, you're going to have a specific period of time that you must be sentenced to and you've got to serve it all. Now, if you're a drug addict or an alcoholic, you need every carrot and stick that can be brought to bear to help you get off that stuff. When you have a mandated sentence that you must serve, you're in a situation in which we can't say to the prisoner, while you're in prison, go into treatment, get sober, stay sober, and you've got a chance of getting out earlier. And when they get out, if they're not on parole because they've served their whole sentence, we're not able to say to the prisoner, look, you gotta go to AA or NA. That's a condition of your parole. If you don't go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings or Narcotics Anonymous meetings, you're going to have your parole revoked. So we lose the carrot and the stick here. And that just makes no sense. I mean, of all the policies we have in the criminal justice field, I think a mandated sentence that you've got to serve is the most inane and insane.
Another sentence that I want to pick out is you say, without rehabilitation, imprisonment is an act of vengeance.
Yeah. Look, we're supposed to, both just as, you know, socially just citizens, provide people in prison an opportunity to change their lives. Pope John talked about this at the millennium speech he gave at the Regina Caeli prison in Rome. But if we don't give them any chance, if we just throw them in prison and they're drug addicts and alcoholics, they're going to come out. And believe me, the first day, we've had programs here at the National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University regarding offenders. If we didn't pick the offender up at the door as he left prison and got him into a program immediately, they basically, almost without exception, celebrated their release by drinking and using drugs the day they got out.
You mentioned John Paul's statement, which you also include in your article from 2000, from America Magazine. Do Catholics have a special responsibility to work for prison rehabilitation?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I think there's no question that social justice, everything I learned in Jesuit schools, high school, and college about social justice, we do. And the prison conditions are horrendous. I mean, I think virtually every pope has tried in one way or another at some time during his term to really get Catholics to focus on that. These are really the most vulnerable, difficult people in our society. And, you know, I'll tell you a story to understand how important this is. I spent many years working for President Johnson, 4 years in the White House. The day I met him, I went down to the ranch, and we were driving around Johnson City, hot July summer day, and there was a guy on the side of the road, and he was scrabbling, and he was a drunk, and he was just lying there with a bottle, and President Johnson turned to me, one hand on the wheel, and took his other hand, and he put his thumb and forefinger almost together, and he said, "You work for me, don't you ever forget that the difference between him and you and him and me is that much." And believe me, for many of these people in prison, any one of us could be there. That's something we should be very sensitive about.
Well, maybe you can speak. You've been in public life for a long time, as you said, under President Johnson, also, of course, under President Carter. It seems like these days it's difficult for a Catholic to be in the public square, to be a public figure. There's a lot of criticism that a Catholic politician can take, both from the hierarchy, but also from his or her constituents. What advice would you have for a Catholic in the public square today?
We need Catholics in the public square today. We need those values. We need people with solid values. This country is a very much instant gratification, relativist country. We need people with firm values there. That's very important. I think. Sure, there are problems. I mean, it's difficult. When I was at HEW, I was attacked both on by people that said they wanted the federal government to fund abortions. Congress passed what we now know as the Hyde Amendment. The Hyde Amendment provided that the government would pay for abortions under Medicaid only in where the life of the mother was at stake, which everyone can agree. Or in cases of rape or incest, promptly reported. This is 1977. We went out and did a survey of women. What we learned was, in 1977, women did not report being raped or being victim of incest unless they thought they were pregnant, by and large. So we put out regulations that said 60 days. Anything within 60 days is prompt reporting. And the reaction of the bishops, and incidentally also President Carter, was to just attack that on the ground that it was too liberal, too permissive, if you will. So I went back to Congress at President Carter's direction. I sent a letter. I said, that's the regulation. You want to change it, change it. But they never did. So you have that kind of problem. That's part of just being an American and a Catholic. But the thing that Catholics can bring to public life is that sense of values. And that sense of values is absolutely consistent with our Constitution, with the dignity of the individual, and with the tremendous need in this country for social justice and for a fair distribution of our resources. You know, how can we be the richest country in the world and have 13% of the population living in abject poverty? Think about that. I mean, going back to the Johnson years, when Johnson took office, 22% of people were in poverty, reduced it to about 12.5% in that 5 or 6 years. It hasn't changed since then. Those are things that Catholics in public office can do something about.
Well, maybe we can end finally by talking about your work here at the center. Maybe you can just explain to our listeners who may not be familiar with it, what's the work you do?
The National Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University, which we call CASA, basically its concept is this, that we would bring together all kinds of different skills, not just medicine and law, but sociology, religion. We've done a report on So Help Me God about religion and substance abuse, communications, business, labor, to look at all substance abuse, alcohol, tobacco, pills, illegal drugs, steroids. This, the concept being the issue is addiction or abuse, not a particular substance. And to look at them and what they do for all parts of society. For the what they do in the workplace, to the school, to the family, to teenage pregnancy. More than half of teenage pregnancies occur when one or both of the kids are high. And we issue public policy papers. One we did, So Help Me God, for example, about 10 years ago. It's still being used. We surveyed priests, ministers, and rabbis who were in the parishes, and we asked them what their major problems were in terms, and of course the biggest problem were family breakup, and the biggest problem there was alcohol and drugs. Then we went to the seminaries and the rabbinical schools, and we surveyed them, and we said, what do you teach about this? And we found that only 12%, this is 77, I think it's, I'm sorry, this was 93, 94, only 12% of those schools actually provided any training. Not that priests and rabbis and ministers should be experts in substance abuse, but they ought to know how to get somebody, how to at least see the signals, and then how to get somebody in treatment. The only archdiocese in the United States which requires, the Archbishop in New Mexico requires that every parish have in its rectory a list of treatment programs and counselors in that area that they can refer people to. That should be in every rectory in the United States. So we do public policy papers, we look at that. We test programs to see what works in prevention and treatment. We do analyses like the ones we've done of the American prison system.
Again, the report we're talking about today is Behind Bars 2, Substance Abuse in America's Prison Population, and you can read a report of that in the current issue of America. Mr. Califano, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim. My pleasure.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the America Magazine podcast. I encourage you to go online where our weekly video feature is from Matthew Maul and Kerry Weber, who's an assistant editor here, and they do a profile of a Catholic community, student community, at Columbia University in New York. We also have a review of the FX television show Justified from Carolyn Martin Buscarino. To respond to our podcast, you can go to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.